The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap and / Film, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I write for / Film. For the purposes of this podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool, but, I mean, you don't have to.
Yeah, but why would you pass up that opportunity?
You can call me what you like.
Yeah. It'd be like if you met, like, Steven Spielberg. It's like, oh, hello, Mr. Spielberg, sir. It's a pleasure to meet you. And he said, no, please, call me Rocco. I'm calling Steven Spielberg Rocco.
I would call him Rocco in perpetuity.
Yeah, like, exactly.
I would hope to speak at his funeral and said, Rocco loved movies.
Anyway, here's how this podcast works. Stop this enable.
Sorry.
Here's how this podcast works. You write us emails or letters. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, you can actually send us a physical letter to P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and as we read them and we respond to your comments, we answer your questions, we do prompts, like if you want us to, like, hey, what's the thing? And really, I don't know, blah. Anyway, emails. That's what we do. Whitney, do you have any emails for us this week? Or is it going to be a very short podcast?
Well, I don't have any emails, but we have emails from our listeners.
Okay.
Here is an email from Dr. Nova.
Hey, Dr. Nova. Good to hear from you again.
From Dr. Nova from time to time.
Get some updates.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, hi, love your podcast. Listen to you all the time. This letter isn't for you.
Oh. I feel so rejected.
Dear straight people.
Wow.
So, to the straight people listening, stop recommending Brokeback Mountain. all in caps. I get it. You talk to one queer person, me right now, and you don't know that I like movies and you think I'm gay, which isn't the case, but God, I'm not coming out to you. Did you guys know there are other queer movies? For children, even. I know you think it's weird that queer kids exist, but you live in Texas. and it's some sort of dystopia there. Look, there are a lot of decent people in Texas.
There are a lot of decent people in Texas.
The people in the Texan government are kind of shitheels, but...
There are people, there are decent people. There's a lot of states are now getting a lot of bad press. Mm. Texas and Florida in particular, but they're definitely not alone. And here's the thing, there are great, wonderful people who live in those states who are being oppressed. Yeah, by all that shit. So just a shout out if you live there and you're trying your best. Bless you. It's so damn difficult everywhere, but especially in some of those places.
We want you to survive, and we know that your governors and politicians aren't you. But it says here. You live in Texas. It's some sort of dystopia there, but you think you're being an ally because you're not being openly hostile. In other places where kids feel safe, they watch movies like Love, Simon, where the entire cast is supportive and good, and all of the people that need to stop being the only people who need to stop being jerks is the dad, who is the kind of person that would ask Simon if he had seen Brokeback Mountain. Two bullies who are bullies and an idiot who doesn't know the consequences of an action. Have you seen Love?
I have seen Love, Simon. Yeah. It's pretty good.
It's
very John Hughes-y.
Yeah. My only issue with Love, Simon is that Simon is, like, super bland.
It's very John Hughes-y.
Yeah. but here's the great thing about Love, Simon. It's like, okay, yes, queer kids get to have bland-ass comedies, too.
Yeah, they get to make terrible mistakes. They get to learn from them. Like, it's okay. It's a good flick. I like that flick.
Anyway, I don't want to watch the sad gay cowboy movie. Never talk to me again, Dr. Nova. P.S. I know Whitney doesn't care for Love, Simon.
It's okay.
Minor quibbles. I don't really hate it. So do you have any suggestions for queer movies kids can watch it that are like Love, Simon?
Oh.
Dr. Nova.
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
I'm trying to think, like, what are some good queer romances?
There aren't
that are like super kid friendly or maybe teen friendly.
Yeah, there really aren't a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but I'm a cheerleader. I mean, that's,
well, that's more for adults.
It's a little bit on the edge, but I would say high school. I would say
older
kid.
Teens. Yeah, yeah, like, but like, that's not like
I think a 14, 15 year old could watch. Yes, but I'm a cheerleader and be okay with it.
But I also think that's not necessarily the same audience. That's very much a different kind of satire, biting coming of age thing. I'm thinking about, like, when I think about John Hughes, for example, I mean, those are, I saw, and some of those movies had bad stuff in them that has aged very, very poorly, or was definitely for more mature audiences or senses of humor, but it wasn't so pervasive that I couldn't appreciate it and sort of let the stuff I didn't understand kind of wash away. But, you know, I grew up watching Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I grew up watching Some Kind of Wonderful. And I did that when I was, like, in elementary school.
Yeah.
And these were teen romances, and that was deemed fine. So, yeah, the realm of queer cinema that would be that mainstream is a relatively recent phenomenon, especially as far as mainstream Hollywood goes.
Yeah.
And there still aren't nearly enough.
Yeah, there was a film I know that's out there that I haven't seen. I actually haven't been able to track it down.
What's that?
It's an animated film called In a Heartbeat, which is an animated film about two boys. Kids are, I think they're like 11.
Okay.
And they like have a crush on each other. It's about two young boys in love. It's just sort of this sweet animated queer romance.
There's Your Name.
Oh, I didn't see Your Name. Oh, that's where they switch bodies, right?
But there's definitely a queer element to it, where it's about a teenage boy and a teenage girl, and every other day they switch bodies.
Uh-huh.
And they start sharing each other's lives. And they start falling for each other, and there's definitely a bit of gender identity in there. I think the movie kind of derails in the second half when it starts explaining what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people love that movie.
Yeah.
And I understand why. It's not my favorite, but I understand why, and I think that's a movie that isn't as on the nose as something like Love, Simon, is definitely approaching that.
What was the name of that lesbian Cyrano film on Netflix from a couple years ago?
Oh, that was a really good one. It was called
The Half of It.
The Half of It. That's
the
a good
half
one.
Of it is a really good, that's one. A it's, good it's one. It's a Cyrano story about a teenage girl who is hired by the local, like, jock.
Yeah.
The star jock at her high school to write love poetry for his crush.
Yeah.
This rather dynamic young artist woman that he's fallen in love with. And the protagonist begins falling in love with the young girl as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a really, really good one. And it takes place, like, in this, like, remote town in Oklahoma, if I recall. that was a really good one. The Half of It was really good.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna actually throw this out because we could think about this for a long time and we could come up with a few more. I want to know from our listeners, especially our queer listeners, what are the more young, family friendly or at least teen friendly queer movies that you would recommend? Because there aren't enough.
Yeah.
That's just true.
Oh, I've got another one.
Oh, yeah.
One from a couple of years ago that I also liked was called To the Stars.
Did I see that one? Which one was that?
You didn't see that one. Okay. That was one of my favorites of that year. It takes place in...
That's like the Eastern European one, isn't it?
No. This takes place in like Kansas.
What am I thinking?
Or no, this one's also rural local. Maybe I was mixing up To the Stars and The Half of It. But this one takes place in Oklahoma in like the 60s.
Okay.
And it's about sort of like the popular girl and the unpopular girl, and they kind of find that they have sort of this mutual bond, and you realize over the course of the film that they're kind of falling in love with each other.
Yeah.
That's a sweet one.
Okay.
I'm trying to think.
No, again, I'm going to throw this out there because, it's Pride Month. Not that we need the excuse, but it is Pride Month. If anyone has any recommendations that they would like to share, especially some that might be a little less obvious, because the crux of the email is there are certain films that tend to break out that are about or focused on or become examples of representation that become such a catch-all, even if they're good. I think Brokeback Mountain is a very good movie. But they just become this whole, I saw that movie. I've seen all there is to see, is a general sentiment, and that's obviously completely wrong. Yeah, bring it on. More recommendations, especially something that maybe you might have flown under our radars. We'd love to know about it.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
Next letter. Here is a letter from Lily. Hello, Lily. Okay. Hey, Bibbs, and oh gosh, Rockmeister McCool, but it's spelled all weird. It's got three R's and an H.
Nice.
And the U in McCool has an umlaut.
The umlaut is silent.
No, it changes the pronunciation of the vowel.
It was a joke.
Okay.
I was making a joke.
But you know what an umlaut is, right?
I know that an umlaut is a what do you call it? A grammatical device that is actually a punctuation that changes the pronunciation of a word. I am aware of that.
Okay.
It was a joke. Moving on.
Here's something I really love. You know the word cooperate?
Yes.
You can spell it with a hyphen if you want.
True.
Or you can spell it with two O's.
Yep.
And it's sort of ironic that the O's in the word cooperate
don't cooperate.
Don't make the same sound.
That is funny, actually.
Cute little grammatical quirk.
I think
quirk.
That's neat.
I'm going to save a lengthy introduction, get right to my question.
Okay.
What are some of your favorite direct-to-streaming movies, TV shows, etc., that have been removed from streaming services for a tax write-off? One of mine is Hush from 2016, a movie that was extremely popular when it came out on Netflix and was recently removed, which I discovered only when I went to rewatch it.
Mm. For the record, Hush, I actually did some checking on this. Hush was not technically a Netflix original. Netflix licensed it for a limited time. That time is now up, and I believe that the original production company, I think it's Blumhouse, could put it on another service at some point. Maybe they're working on a home video release finally. I don't know. Mike Flanagan, who directed that movie, became kind of a big deal afterwards. He directed Dr. Sleep. He directed a whole bunch of really successful Netflix shows. Something tells me that won't be gone for long, but it is currently gone as best as I understand it, and that does suck.
Yeah.
So there is hope for Hush.
Okay.
That's what I will say. Regarding stuff that is gone for tax write-off purposes, I'm trying to remember exactly gone.
The letter's not done yet.
Okay, fair enough. Right. I'm gonna look up the list here.
I couldn't see Hush because when I went to rewatch it wasn't there. It's one of my favorites of the home invasion genre with absolutely fantastic tension, and where most movies in the genre either get repetitive or too dark to be fun. I love funny games, but it's not an enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
It strikes the balance perfectly. I also love John Gallagher Jr.'s performance in it. He is not some giant, angry, scary villain, but an average white guy that looks a whole lot more like real-life killers. I mean, excited to hear your thoughts, Lily. I'd have to check to see what has been removed.
Artemis Fowl has been removed.
That hit.
Yeah.
The one where Josh Gad eats dirt and poops it out his butt.
Hey, listen, it should be available. No one's arguing that it should be. Yes. It all should be available, even if it stinks. It should all be available. But I think that one's funny because that was supposed to be a big theatrical release originally.
Yeah.
And it got put on Disney Plus because of the pandemic. And even now, it's just gone. Yeah. Oh, Black Beauty is gone. That was supposed to be a really good one. Their 2020 Black Beauty?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Let's see here.
I just find it incredibly galling that when streaming services first started up, we were all operating under the misapprehension that they were building an archive.
Yeah.
That they're going to start putting these movies on streaming and you'll just have permanent access to them.
Wouldn't that have been nice?
Wouldn't that have been nice? If I were... When I run for president, I'm going to start a Library of Congress. Library of Congress streaming service. A permanent archive of all of the films on it. That will be free to the American citizens.
They do have some of that, but it's all stuff that's in like public domain.
Yeah.
You know, like you can see like a whole bunch of like silent movies and I think newsreels and things, you know, that kind of stuff actually.
I would like the Library of Congress to be open to everyone digitally. That would be nice.
I agree.
Netflix, you know, they had their mail-in service and then they started their streaming service. I remember what a coup it was when they started producing their own shows.
Yeah.
It's like, I thought you were a video store, like this archive of movies. Isn't this sort of like the delivery boy hustling you his own pizzas on the side? And then it just sort of became standard. All of the streaming services, in order to stay competitive with each other, started offering big new hit shows, and now some of the biggest shows of all time are just on streaming. The archives started to dwindle. All of the money went into these original programs. Mm-hmm. And then it started coming out in recent years that they can get gigantic tax write-offs if they don't make any money off of something. Like, if they take a loss on something, then...
And just agree never to try to make money off of it again.
So, if they just sort of lock it up and nobody ever sees it, and they don't sell it, they can get this huge kickback from the government. And it's really sad that not seeing art is worth more to them than seeing art.
Yeah, preserving it.
Follows necessarily art, but...
Think about how many things that Disney or Warner Brothers or all the other studios have done that didn't find an audience until years, sometimes many years later.
Well, what
you know?
I find...
Like that, they wasn't able to become a hit, to make the money, until people found it. When you look at... Just go to Netflix. Mm. If you go to Netflix, you'll see like what's trending right now. What are the most watched movies on Netflix right now? And you'll see that at almost any given time, there's like some random ass movie.
Yeah, like Eraser. That came out like,
Eraser or Ma, that Octavia Spencer movie. Which was a fun thriller, but it kind of came and went and no one really cared. And then all of a sudden, it's like the number one most watched movie on Netflix. That couldn't happen if it wasn't available. You can't do that. I'm looking right now at a list of a lot of things I've been seeing. A lot of them are stuff I haven't seen because it's a lot of stuff, a lot of TV shows. Some stuff that I liked that I'm already looking at. On Hulu, there was a really good action movie called The Princess starring Joey King.
Which was pretty good.
It was really good.
Violent action film in a tower kind
of
thing.
It was Die Hard if Die Hard was a fairy tale. So imagine like a princess is like trapped at like the top of a tower. An evil king has come in and says, I'm going to marry the princess and take over the castle. But the princess has been studying, like, fighting, like, on the side, and ends up, like, killing an entire army worth of guys with, like, swords and martial arts and shit. Mm. And it's great. It's really fun. It's a great slumber party movie. It should have been a huge hit.
The Willow TV series was taken. Yep. I didn't watch that, but that seems odd.
I heard it was good.
That was one of the things they were gunning for, Disney was, that is, when they purchased Lucasfilm. They didn't just get Star Wars in that purchase. They also got Indiana Jones, Willow, and all the other George Lucas stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a new Indiana Jones film coming out that was part of their deal. They made one, and there's also talk of like a new young Indiana Jones Chronicles TV series. They kind of... milked Star Wars really dry theatrically. Nobody wants to see Star Wars movies in theaters anymore.
No, they'll want to see them on home video, which is or streaming, which is fine. But they kind of started
pushing that in the TV direction.
They flat out announced we're going to do a Star Wars a year, and it's like Star Wars isn't that varied. Actually, I think you're going to run out of Star Wars, and they did. Let's see a few other things.
But then Willow was part of that. They were going to do Willow. They got the original cast, or they got Warwick Davis back anyway.
Yeah, I think they had one or two other people too. I didn't see it, but it was good.
They made a TV series out of Willow, and now they just don't care.
There's an animated series from J.G. Quintel I quite liked. I didn't watch all of it, but I really liked what I saw. J.G. Quintel did a show called Regular Show, which is one of my favorite Cartoon Network shows, and it is about a blue oriole and I think a raccoon who work at a park, and they're just slacker dudes who like really love stuff from the 90s, and their whole episode's about how like laser discs was actually the most superior home video medium, and there's a whole conspiracy to keep it down, and Close Enough was like his take on being like in your 30s. And they were, it was a little hit or miss, but I thought it was really, really funny, and I connected with it a lot. What was another one? Full Frontal with Samantha Bee is apparently been taken off of HBO Max. That was a great show. Yeah, that was a legitimately great,
trying to find some other lists here. Yeah. The 12 Dates of Christmas is gone.
Okay, that's a shame. Yeah, agreed. You laugh, but I think it is.
I know that's one you've seen.
I believe it is.
Elmo's talk show.
Oh, I heard that was cute.
Elmo had a talk show that's taken away.
Yeah. Jeez, I'm trying to trying to see. There's got to
be... My Dinner with Hervé, the...
Oh, really?
Hervé Villechaize, HBO original. That one's gone.
Whoa, Metalocalypse got taken down.
Oh, that's a pity.
That sucks. That's a classic.
I like Metalocalypse.
Yeah, Metalocalypse is a big fucking deal. That's a
Cartoon Network show Uncle Grandpa is gone.
Okay, that was really popular. I remember that.
Pac-Man and the Ghostly Adventure. I didn't even know about the Pac-Man show, but okay. Looking at these lists. There's like
it's staggering. And if you like, do that.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
I'm of two minds.
Space Ghost Coast to Coast.
Fuck you.
Fuck you for taking that down.
Space Ghost Coast to Coast is
Must live forever.
A masterpiece of modern Dadaism. It is art.
It is. I is no exaggeration here. Space Ghost Coast to Coast is the thing that made Adult Swim. They were doing before. They did stuff after. But the weird crossover success of Space Ghost Coast to Coast had such an impact. Space Ghost Coast to Coast like led directly into like stuff like C-Lab, more repurposed Hanna-Barbera animation characters, for comedy purposes.
Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, those shows. The
Powerpuff Girls debuted in a Space Ghost episode.
Nice.
It totally did. And I think so did Dexter's Lab, same episode.
Well, I remember when Cartoon Network first began, they had four hit new shows. There was Powerpuff Girls.
Yeah.
There was Johnny Bravo, Ed and Eddie,
was it Dexter's Lab?
Dexter's Laboratory.
Yeah, yeah.
Craig McCracken was a big part. Gendy Tartakovsky was in there. Yeah. Some important names in animation. Those were the four big launch shows. But yeah, Space Ghost Coast to Coast was getting them in the 90s.
And listen, some of these shows, it's my understanding that some of these shows are gone for tax write-off purposes, and some of them are the sort of things that they might end up, if they haven't already, selling to other streaming services in order to make more money off them that way. And I've already started seeing shows that were initially like, oh, yeah, if you want to see this animated Batman show, you got to go to the Warner Brothers streaming service because they own Batman. And I'm like, that makes sense. That's why I would buy that.
Well, but then they start licensing the characters and other streaming services.
Well, now I've noticed that Justice League and the Batman and a bunch of other like DC superhero stuff is back on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go. Mm-hmm. So again, keep an eye out. Some of these things may reappear. And again, just because we haven't seen them doesn't mean anything because there's so much stuff. No one has to see all of it, but that's why it's all here someone.
I was going to say, I'm of two minds of this. I don't like that art has no value to these streaming services.
Oh, that's
horrible. It's all about the algorithms and chasing numbers and making money. There's always been a commercial aspect to most arts, but when that's what takes precedent or when it feels like it, that's a problem. That's bad. But at the same time, in the race to get eyeballs and to get dollars, they most certainly oversaturated the market. Mm-hmm. There were way too many of these shows to catch up with and way too many of these movies. While it's nice that it was all out there, there was no way to keep up with all of it. So, you know, the spending had to stop. And in a way, it's sort of like giving us a breather.
And listen, I'm okay with production winding down and going in cycles where we produce a lot, we produce a little less. That's a natural ebb and flow, give and take. Mm. It's removing things from ever being found again.
That's the issue.
That's the thing that's fucked. And that is something that is genuinely terrifying to anyone who cares about, but anyone who also makes art, because you spend years out of your life in most cases making these TV shows, and now no one will ever see them. And because no one will ever see them, not only are you not getting residuals, which was something you were relying on, but also no one else is going to see that work, and so that'll make it harder for you to get more future work. It's a general understanding that when you create something, you're creating it to be seen. I shouldn't have to explain that to anybody. That's the whole point of creation. It's not to just hide it away somewhere. Especially when you're hired to, because then what the hell is the point? It's absolutely staggering. It's absolutely terrifying. I hate every single part of it. And, by the way, my computer's being very loud right now, so if you're hearing some white noise or something like that, that's why. Knock it off, computer, you're bad. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it sucks. This whole deal sucks.
Yeah. The lesson here is buy physical media.
Yeah.
I understand that it's really pricey, but if you consider keeping track of your favorite shows will require subscribing to random or even multiple streaming services, I mean, it kind of shakes out to be the same.
I think physical media, everyone was like, physical media is going to go away entirely. I think it's just going to turn a bit more niche, like vinyl. You know, yeah, like it'll I think there's definitely going to be an audience for this, but it's going to be people buying 4Ks, Criterions,
Shout Factories. There's a couple you know? Tiffany labels to really keep an eye on. Criterion's one of them. Pretty pricey, but you know, worth it when they have the half off sales.
But like Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome. They'll find movies that sometimes
specialty people, outlets yeah, really do
and
it.
They won't like put them out forever, or they won't make a million copies of them, but they'll make them so that if you wanted to make sure you always had a copy of Troop Beverly Hills, by God.
The Shout Factory's probably got that one.
I think that was Arrow, actually, who did that.
Arrow did Troop Beverly Hills?
I think. Hold on, let me see. Hold on. There was a Blu-ray that came out a couple years ago.
I got a pair of box sets from Arrow Video very recently. I got the Shinya Tsukamoto box set, the guy who did Tetsuo the Iron Man. Oh. They just have this box set of all of his movies. Really great. It has all three of the Tetsuo movies. Tokyo Fist, Bullet Ballet, I think it's called. Lot of his works. And I also got the Herschel Gordon Lewis box set, which I'm very happy to have.
I guess Sony put that one out. I could have sworn there was like a special Troop Beverly Hills that had come out from someone or other.
Arrow did a really impressive box set for the movie Wild Things. Nice. It comes with like multiple discs and posters.
Well,
and
that one actually warrants it. Wild Things is actually a pretty great movie.
It's high trash at its highest.
Well, it's the best possible trash. It's very well crafted.
It's really actually sweaty.
The screenplay of that thing should have been nominated for an Oscar. Like, it's a really smartly constructed film noir screenplay.
Yeah.
So
it's just a really sleazy movie.
Oh, it's an incredibly sleazy movie, but it's sleazy with a point.
Yeah, no,
it's not just sleazy to be sleazy, which is fine in and of itself.
I was gonna say that's descriptive, not a pejorative.
Yeah, no, like you can be sleazy for its own sake. That's a perfectly valid thing to be, but it's also you're only trying so hard.
Yeah,
Wild Things actually had ideas, and it was an intelligent movie that happened to also be very, very sleazy.
Old physical media collectors like me, we used to follow where we would see a film come out, like, new on the market, but we understood that there was a really thriving used video market as well, or used record market.
Yeah.
So we would go get these videos, go to the store, look at the videos, see, I don't want to spend $20 on that, be willing to spend $8. So we'd end up going to the used record stores, places like Penny Lane. Mm-hmm. We'd kind of hold out. We'd wait for the price.
Penny Lane.
Penny Lane was really great.
Penny Lane was this relatively small, but in Southern California, there were a lot of them.
Or a couple of them.
You find them in Pasadena, you find them in Westwood, you can find them around. But they were used CD and video stores.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had a bunch of posters, and they always had,
like tchotchkes, mugs.
I always wanted to work there. Those were the cool video store guys.
They had the stuff that Hot Topic sells now, but when that stuff was, like, kind of rare and niche and like, cool and a little bit edgy.
Yeah, if you wanted, like, a framed poster of the House on Haunted Hill, the original, you get that at Penny Lane. Pretty cheap. You know, like, it was great.
Godzilla mug.
God, so many movies that are still in my collection are probably
from Penny Lane. Yeah, if you still have the price tickers on them, leave them on there.
Oh, yeah. Memories. They won't raise the price or anything like that. They're just fun.
We were shopping so often, and there were so many options when it came to record stores, that we could just go to the used record stores, and we could get the videos for cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had to spend many, many years breaking ourselves of that habit. If you see something on physical media, it's brand new, and it's full price...
Mm-hmm.
You just got to pony up and get it right then.
If you can afford it, get it.
Because
you just don't know.
There's not a secondhand market necessarily, and if there is, it's on eBay and the price is only going to go up. It's not going to go down.
Mm.
It's really rare now that a video will leave the market or a record will leave the market, and you find it cheaper elsewhere later.
Mm-hmm.
So
every once in a while, it's weird, though, because I'll go to
It's kind of unfortunate that you have to spend so much money. But yeah.
there's one exception to that, though, and that's the sort of dime store bins. Like, if you go to 7-Eleven, they sometimes have a bunch of DVDs.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Or if you go to Rite Aid, like, next to all of their, like, trashy airplane novels, they'll have a bunch of DVDs and Blu-rays, and every once in a while, you look at there, and I'm like, this is a good deal. Like, this is, like, a complete like Saw box set for like $20 in Blu-ray, and you're like, yeah, that's good. So never pass those up. Always give those a gander, because you'll find some gold in there, and it's usually underpriced when they go to that market. So anyway, let's move on.
All right, here's a letter from the Gorilla Walrus Ninja.
Nice.
I just read what's at the bottom. I don't read from the subject line. If you don't sign off, it's name redacted. Yep. Hello, Bibbs and Rockmeister. McCool. Do the choices of actors make you lose or gain respect for them on a professional level? Mm. I'm thinking of Robert De Niro versus Leonardo DiCaprio. Robert De Niro is obviously a great actor who has been in some of the best films ever made. He also has a problem saying no. It seems that in the last 20 years, he will do anything. That includes some really terrible movies. Compare this to Leonardo DiCaprio, who only acts in one film every few years, but that film is usually an Oscar-nominated classic. Doesn't mean DiCaprio is a better actor than some of the other A-list stars, but he does seem to be very choosy with what he'll do. As a critic, do you prefer this method, or does it not really matter if a great actor will fill his filmography with a lot of crap mixed in with the gold? Thank you, the Gorilla Walrus.
That's a great question, actually, and it's something that we talk about kind of a lot, but we don't always like come at it from that angle. The idea of the choices that certain artists make and how those choices kind of accumulate and affect how we view them. Some actors start down one path and then find success in this one medium and then very much switch. John C. Reilly, for example, started his career as a very serious actor, was in a lot of dramas, and then somewhere around the Talladega Nights, Step Brothers era, people realized just how incredibly funny he was, and now he's probably better known as a comedian than as a serious dramatic actor.
I would say something like Boogie Nights was the turning point for
him. Because that was both. He was a serious role and it was funny.
Drama, but also, and he's worked with P.T. Anderson a bunch. I've tried to be a little bit more diplomatic when it comes to like actors' choices, because it's their friggin' choice. They get to do whatever
they want.
Sometimes
it's their choice. Sometimes it's what they're offered.
Yeah, sometimes what they're offered. Sometimes, you know, it's a matter of just the work they can get at the time.
I remember I read an interview with John Travolta like back in the late 90s. And this is back when like John Travolta was having like, you know, a huge career resurgence. Like after Pulp Fiction, he was in Broken Arrow and Face Off
and Get Shorty
and Primary Colors. And after like being really, really huge in the 70s and having his career kind of nosedive in the 80s, pop up really briefly with Look Who's Talking and then drop right back down with Look Who's Talking 2 and 3. Pulp Fiction remade his career, and he parlayed that into becoming a major leading man and one of the top grossing actors in Hollywood with another Oscar nomination under his belt. He did really, really good for himself. But he was doing an interview, and what made you decide to do Pulp Fiction was basically the question. And he said, it was literally the only screenplay I'd been offered.
Wow.
That was the last one. No one was knocking on my door. I had made too many duds. Yeah. I had made too many bad decisions. And I was at a point where I was just, no one was offering me anything. And it was basically do Pulp Fiction or do nothing.
Yeah.
You can be at that point. And
I will always remember an interview I read once with Emilio Estevez, of all people. Because he moved to he's directed his whole career, but he was hawking his new movie, Bobby, the one about Robert Kennedy. And they asked him, you know, it's like, and you know, you did all these movies and then you were like in all, like a lot of different pictures and then you just weren't for a while. What happened? He just said, I didn't stop working on purpose.
Yeah.
Just people weren't hiring him. Didn't want to hire Emilio Estevez. He wasn't hip anymore. He was unpopular.
His movies aren't making money. Your movies don't make money. You get fewer roles. Sometimes you can ride it out if people really like working with you. Like, I remember hearing about Freddie Prinze Jr. in the turn of the century. And there were so many movies that were trying to make Freddie Prinze Jr. an actor I respect. He could be a very good actor. I really liked him in Star Wars Rebels. I got nothing against Freddie Prinze Jr. As far as I know. But he was in one underperforming kind of romantic movie after another.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like, with the exception of Scooby-Doo, which was more of an ensemble thing, no matter how hard Hollywood tried, he could not become a hit star. But they kept trying. And it's my understanding it's because people liked working with him.
He's just a nice guy.
Yeah, people like working with him. They'll only take you so far, but that will take you pretty far if they believe in you, you know? So... these things happen. When it comes to, you know, actors who will do anything or seem like they'll do anything, my philosophy is this. Well, it's twofold. One, when you're an actor, you don't know if the movie's going to turn out good. Sometimes you get a
successful.
You can get a great screenplay, you sign on to do a great screenplay, and then it doesn't get directed very well, or parts get miscast, or it gets rewritten and no longer works the way it used to.
People don't see it for whatever reason.
I'm talking about just when sometimes the actual movie does turn out bad, which happen.
Yeah.
But sometimes you make a really, really good movie and nobody seems to care for some reason because of timing or too much competition or whatever. That's not the actor's fault. You did the best you could. You were hired to play a role. You played the role really good. Hopefully. That's all you can do. And it's a crapshoot. And there's a lot of actors out there, really, really great actors, who could absolutely have been as big, as popular, as successful as any of the big movie stars you're thinking of right now when you think of big movie stars. And the brakes just never broke.
Yeah.
They were in a movie, it seemed like it was going to be a hit, it wasn't, and then they couldn't get another big role after that, and it sucked. Think of someone like, I don't know, Taylor Kitsch. Hollywood tried really hard with Taylor Kitsch. He started John Carter and Battleship. Those were supposed to be two of the biggest movies of the year. And you know what? I like both of those movies. I like both of those movies. Those movies are really, really fun. Are they great? No, there's glimpses of greatness in John Carter, but it's not a great movie. But they're not his fault either. He did fine. It's just it didn't work out. I personally admire an actor who has a really strong work ethic and just likes working.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be in good movies, but Ben Kingsley's been in a lot of shit, but he keeps working, you know?
I've noticed this, and what we're talking about here, you know, De Niro, DiCaprio, you're a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
How much are you a movie star? How much are you concerned about the public's perception of you?
Yeah.
How much are you selling yourself as a product?
Mm-hmm.
And how much are you an actor? How much do you like to delve into your craft?
Mm-hmm.
How much do you like to get into characters? There are actors who don't give a damn about being a movie star, and there are movie stars who aren't really great actors.
That's true. That's very fair.
I feel like some of the greatest movie stars we have aren't necessarily great actors. Mm. Arnold Schwarzenegger is not a good actor. He would agree with me.
I think he would. He's had a good role here or there, but he was usually tailor-made to his very specific strengths.
And he is such a charming, outsized personality that he's magnetic on screen. You want to watch Arnold Schwarzenegger in an action picture because he has that kind of movie star capability to him. It works with him.
Yeah. Then you have someone like Daniel Day-Lewis, who clearly did not want to be a movie star.
Even
when he was in a movie star role, you watch Michael Mann's Last of the Mohicans. Amazing, epic adventure.
Big Hollywood picture.
Romantic, sexy, action-packed. One of the best musical scores ever put to cinema, if you ask me. He's great in that. That is a movie star role, if ever there was one. He could have parlayed that into big movie star type roles. He actively chose not to.
Yeah. But that sort of like movie star versus actor thing.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenon in sort of the higher end of Hollywood acting biz. It's also incredibly American, and you'll notice if you go over to England.
Yeah.
And I noticed this with Anthony Hopkins, because I saw him popping up in big action blockbusters, but also like little tiny dramas, and also these really weird, intense Hollywood projects that make no sense to him, like Instinct.
Like weird or thrillers
Road
or
to
horror
Wellville,
movies.
Which is really odd. A bunch of horror movies. It's like, what is he doing with his career? And the answer is, whatever he wants.
Yeah.
He's a big enough star that he can take the job in front of him, and he's such a professional, and he has a very particular work ethic unique to the Isles, where he's going to throw himself into wholly whatever the role is.
There's one exception to that. I actually just saw a thing today where Anthony Hopkins was talking about working on the Thor movies.
Oh, yeah.
And he was just like, once you're working in green screen, you stop trying.
Okay, yeah.
It's just makes no point at that point. Mm-hmm. You're against the green screen, you just say your lines and you move on.
I remember Kathleen Turner said something like, she was in a what was that witch movie she was in with Martin Short? It was a while back. Like Merle Wilson was in it.
It was like a simple wish.
There's a scene that she was talking about filming, and they put her on like this big pole, so she's like floating around against this blue screen, and like making these witch noises, like trying to menace the other actors. And she was talking about it's like that's not really acting anymore, is it?
Yeah,
you're just they're hanging you from a pole and you're bouncing around,
dudes.
The cats are knocking stuff over
what
again.
What if you just didn't, Dante? What if so, you didn't knock things over. Have you tried?
So, I will lose respect for an actor if they, consistently work for a filmmaker I hate.
Mm-hmm. If they do something unethical that we're aware of, obviously, we'll lose a lot of respect for them.
But at the same time, I don't like Uwe Boll's movies, but, you know, I'm not going to fault anybody for consistently working with Uwe Boll.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Roberts needs work. Michael Paré needs work.
I'm not going to begrudge anyone for doing work unless, again, there's an actual, you're actually supporting someone on Ethical's career, have a problem. But generally speaking, you get a role. This is actually, Uwe Boll had a bit about this. Uwe Boll, if you don't know who we're talking about, Uwe Boll is a filmmaker. There was a time when he was considered one of the worst filmmakers who ever lived. Now he's not really considered at all. But
stop making movies after a while.
I mean, I think he's still working, but he does so much straight-to-video stuff that isn't really getting any traction. But there was a time
He's German. I think he's making a lot of German films.
He might be, there was a time when Uwe Boll was a filmmaker who, through sheer moxie, got the rights or got attached to a whole bunch of adaptations of pretty popular video games. Not necessarily video games that all had a lot of traction to this day, but popular video games. He directed video game versions of Far Cry, which is actually still a huge franchise. And, that's actually one of his better movies, even though it's not
Alone
good.
Alone in the Dark, Blood Rain, House of the Dead.
House of the Dead.
House of the Dead.
The first House of the Dead. The second one's actually pretty good, but he didn't do that one.
He did a film version of Postal, which I heard was actually, if you're into like daring idiot humor, then that's the kind of thing for you.
In any case, most of them were genuinely terrible, but even though they were low budget, weren't great screenplays, or if they were great screenplays, they stopped being great screenplays, and a lot of screenwriters have talked about how difficult it was to work with Uwe Boll, they would still get big cast members. You look at Blood Rain.
Ben Kingsley in it.
It got Ben Kingsley, and this is a pretty good time for Ben Kingsley. It was around the time he was doing, House of Sand and Fog. He just got another Oscar nomination. He was doing Sexy Beast around that time. Pretty good time. He's in that movie. He barely gets out of his chair. There's a scene where he has to sword fight Kristanna Loken, who would probably best known to this day for the evil Terminator in Terminator 3. She's fun in it. He sword fights the protagonist of the film. There's a bit where it's like, oh shit, he just did some really cool move and totally took our hero off their guard. That's the moment. He stepped forward slightly. that's what he did. But people would ask Uwe Boll, how do you get all these actors? How do you get a movie that is clearly a low budget, kind of underwhelming fantasy epic based off the Dungeon Siege games? And how do you get a cast that consists of, but not limited to, Jason Statham, Ray Liotta, Matthew Lillard at a time when that was actually pretty cool? No disrespect. It's just he was a bigger actor at the time.
He's still working.
He's still working. Again, no disrespect. Just he was a bigger actor at the time. How do you get all these actors? And he said, here's the trick. Burt Reynolds was in that movie. Here's the trick. Ask them if they're available at the last minute. If you don't care who is cast in your movie, if you do not care who plays the roles, you can get a movie star to play that role, provided you pay them well, and you ask them at the last minute if there's a hole in their schedule. And then whoever has a hole in their schedule will be in your movie, they will accept the paycheck, they may or may not do a good job, but boom, you got a big actor in your movie. That's a great producer! I'm not sure it's a great director, but that's a great that guy produces! He will produce a movie star for you. Not necessarily the best person for the job, but he will produce a movie star. Anyway, long and short of it, too late. I don't disrespect an actor for being in a bunch of movies as opposed to a few movies. I don't even disrespect an actor for being in a bunch of bad movies, provided that they're still doing the effort and being good. If I see them not being good in a lot of movies, then I might lose some respect for the actor, because I don't think they're acting very well.
Sometimes I think this might be the sort of the crux of the letter. Mm. Robert De Niro is a very capable actor. He can do any kind of role. Sure. And, you know, he's, I think he's in his late 70s now.
At least,
turned 80. He's an old guy. And, you know, he can do whatever he wants to save up money when he's older.
He was just in that kind of rom-com About My Father.
It was called About My Father.
Yeah, and you know what? It's not a role that asked a lot of him. He didn't phone it in. He's doing the job,
It would be neat to see him continue to sort of stretch even into his old age.
He's 79.
79, yeah. Just kind of do something really unusual and difficult.
He was in The Irishman a couple years ago.
Yeah, it's true.
He
did that.
Yeah.
It's when an actor kind of starts to rest on their laurels that can be a little frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really want Robert Downey Jr. back.
Yeah.
Like, he coasted on those Iron Man films. He could be incredibly successful.
I can't blame him
for it. And
then
he tried to do other high-profile projects, and what the hell was The Judge?
It was...
Or Dr. Doolittle.
Those are two very different things. The Judge was, he was in the middle of the Marvel movies, and he was like, people will pay to see me do Iron Man. They'll pay to see me do Sherlock Holmes. Am I a big enough movie star? Will they pay to see me do anything? I'm going to do a mid-range, all-star, like, courtroom melodrama. Where I play a hotshot lawyer in a small town, but the difference is that my dad is the judge and he hates me. It's by Robert Duvall, who got an Oscar nomination for it. It's not his best work. It's not a good movie.
It's
a pretty lousy melodrama, actually. It's ham-handed. It's got a weird sense of humor. Robert Downey Jr. is fine in it. The acting is fine. It's just not a very good movie. But on top of not being a very good movie, nobody saw it. Because that kind of proved right then and there that audiences weren't interested in Robert Downey Jr. They were interested in Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man.
Yeah.
Since then, he hasn't tried a lot of other things. He would do small roles. He was in Chef. Very, very good. But he's only in it for like two scenes.
Yeah.
After Iron Man ended, or his time in Marvel Cinematic Universe ended, he was like, I'm going to do another huge franchise, but it's going to be a family-friendly thing. No shame in that. Dr. Doolittle, beloved series of books. The Rex Harrison movie is kind of a joke, but it's a sweet little film. It's not like it's nothing to be like ashamed of. It's just a silly family movie lark from the late 60s. The movie sucked.
Yeah.
It was a very, very bad film. He wasn't very good in it, but you got the impression he was at least putting some energy into it. But Robert Downey Jr., before all that, was one of the most interesting actors of his generation. He was, even when the movie sucked, he was interesting. Like, what was that one thriller he did with Neil Jordan?
Oh, it was called In Dreams.
Yeah. Weird fucking film.
It was a very strange movie.
Yeah, there you go. He's pretty dang good in that really dang bad John Grisham movie, The Gingerbread Man, which I think also had Robert Duvall in it. People don't want to see him do it, I guess. It's a shame. I do.
He's done Shakespeare before. I've seen him do Shakespeare.
Sure, he was in Richard III.
He was in Richard III.
Great movie.
I'd like to see him do more like classical theater kind of roles. Cool. He is capable of so much as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Iron Man made sure he's going to be rich forever.
Yeah.
And
deservedly so.
Also, at least as of this recording, has kind of stymied his career. And I'd love to see him stretch and do more interesting things.
And this is what we talk about sometimes when people say this actor got hired for a Marvel movie. And we're like, that's kind of a shame, actually. Yeah. And on one hand, it's cool for them.
They get a lot of money for those.
They get a lot of exposure.
Well,
they get a
also,
lot of...
Also, not necessarily.
Well,
talk to someone like Karen Gillan. She's like, I didn't get paid a lot to play Nebula.
I interviewed Rene Russo once, and we talked about you got all that sweet Thor money. She's like, no, I did not.
You got $500
for it. She did not get well paid for that movie. But regardless, you star in these movies, it's obviously a big boost to your visibility. You know, you might be able to parlay that into something, and some people do, but it's something if you really committed to it, you're not just going to play like a one-off villain, you're stuck doing it for a long time, and that just prevents you from doing other potentially more interesting work.
Yeah.
And as a fan of not necessarily the performer who just wants them to be successful because I like them fine, and I don't know them, so I have no idea, but I like movies, and I like performances, and I want to see a whole bunch of them, and I want them to be different and interesting, and I want you to be able to do a whole bunch of different interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And listen, if you don't, and you just want them to be in this Marvel movie or whatever, that's cool too. We're allowed to value different things.
Mm.
But the thing is, we should be able to say what we value. Like, here's what I, as someone who has a particular perspective on movies based on my history, my education or research, whatever you want to call it, my job, my age, my gender, my sexual identity, all these things kind of come together. I will say, here's what I want. This is what I would like to see. And you will say, this is what you'd like to see. And then they'll make movies based on what information they gather from that. Mm-hmm. It's okay to say, I'm not super interested in seeing this person get stuck doing Marvel movies, or I am.
Hmm.
One of you's gonna win out. The part will get played by somebody. Anyway, we got off on a whole tangent. I think we have time for one or two more.
Here is a letter from Austin. Hello, Austin.
Hello.
Hello, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool, a longtime listener, first-time caller. Mm-hmm. I came across YouTube back when it was just canceled too soon with the swanky intro music. Remember Barry and Levon from the state intro?
Yeah. We asked a friend of ours to create some podcast intro music for the first, 50 episodes of Canceled Too Soon. And... I don't know if I wasn't articulate about what I wanted, but what we got back was like this weirdly sexy music, and we just kind of leaned into it.
Kind of funky.
It was very strange, but it wasn't really what we wanted. But it was fun though, and it was cute, and it came out kind of amusing. But eventually, we got someone to give us something more along the lines of what we were interested in. So. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole.
Oh, but he says it's been awesome watching you two and your shows. You two and your shows continue to grow. There's also a part of what inspired me to start my own movie review blog a few months ago, which has been a ton of fun to write. It's so much fun to write about movies.
Mm-hmm.
It feels great to use my love of film to put something into the world. On the most recent episode of The Iron List, you mentioned A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, a movie I also adore. One of the many things I love is its music, which fits the mood incredibly well, in particular the scene of the girl dancing along in her place shortly after we meet her. There's a link to that song. And it's backed by a song which really stuck with me, and upon tracking it down, I fell in love with the artist. It is a song called Dancing Girls by an artist named Farah, F-A-R-A-H. And that's not the only time I had heard something like that happening. I got around to diving into David Bowie's complete works after seeing Moon Age Daydream last year. So my question is, what artists or songs did you become fans of in this way? That is, deciding to check in with them after hearing them in a movie, whether it was your first time hearing them or the catalyst for diving deep. Thank you so much for all you do. Mm-hmm. You're super appreciated. Sincerely, Austin. P.S. A special slow thanks for your slow/bleak cinema suggestions. I've gained an immense appreciation for the style, and it comes to some of my favorite movies, most notably An Elephant Sitting Still. Everyone should see An Elephant Sitting Still. And most recently, Goodbye, Dragon Inn. Everyone should see Goodbye, Dragon Inn. It's one of the best of all time.
I'll get around to
both of which I watched after hearing your praise for them.
That's a great question, actually.
Yeah, what music have you discovered via movies?
There's a lot. Obviously, there are certain songs. And it's always weird when you discover an older song through a movie.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's introduced to a song at some point for the first time. And if you weren't alive or very old when it first came out, you might have just missed it.
Yeah,
for example, heard Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time in Wayne's World.
Yeah, same.
Queen was huge.
Oh, you know what? I actually heard it shortly before. But
fair enough. But Queen was really, really huge in the 70s and the 80s. And by the late 80s, when I was getting just old enough to start paying attention to music, kind of petered out a little bit in popularity. You know, they just hadn't, been at the forefront for a little bit, and I'd heard some other stuff, Another One Bites the Dust, but Bohemian Rhapsody, when you see it in Wayne's World, is a discovery. the Wayne's World soundtrack, the Wayne's World soundtrack was to Bohemian Rhapsody what the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack was to every song on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. Mm. There's an entire generation that didn't know how cool that was yet. And maybe they only just narrowly missed it, but by God, they know how cool it is now.
I kind of resent that Guardians of the Galaxy popularized Hooked on a Feeling by Blue Swede, because that was already on the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack.
Yeah, the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack was introduced to me. Yeah. I didn't become a huge Blue Swede fan the way I became a Queen fan, for example. But
you know who's a big Blue Swede fan? No one. No one knows who Blue Swede is. Yeah, Hooked on a Feeling is my favorite Blue Swede song.
The cover.
Yeah, it's not even theirs.
Shit, I'm trying to think now. I became a big fan of Jim Steinman through Streets of Fire. I hadn't really been a fan before then.
Jim Steinman is allowed for Streets of Fire.
Yes.
Anything outside of Streets of Fire, no.
Oh, shut up,
Jim Steinman.
So many of his Meatloaf songs are great. You stop it. He did.
His songs have a lot of words. He did Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Total Eclipse of the Heart. Mm. There was a time in my life, and this is, I am not making this up. And I think this says a lot about me. I had on an iPod or on my phone or wherever I was connecting to my dashboard radio at the time, Total Eclipse of the Heart on a loop. Mm. In my car for months.
You have like a single or something? No, I
was
flipping over?
It was just repeat on my iPod or whatever it was, right. I was using. I swear to God, just listened to Total Eclipse of the Heart everywhere I drove for months. And I regret none of that time.
You know what? We all have our embarrassing radio.
I'm not embarrassed. I'm proud.
You know, in the early 2000s, I went through a pretty brutal breakup. Mm-hmm. Just completely devastated me. And the only way to sort of get back on my feet was to listen to Bubblegum, something light. Yeah. And that was when I discovered Radio Disney. So there was a lot of like teeny bopper music from the early 2000s that I should not be familiar with, but am. Mm-hmm. I could tell you about the A-Teens or Bewitched. or Element, spelled LMNT. There's all these, like,
Yeah.
I know these bands.
Yeah.
Do you know the gimmick with the A-Teens?
Oh, didn't they just do ABBA?
The A stands for ABBA. ABBA-Teens.
ABBA's another one. I discovered ABBA through Muriel's Wedding.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'd heard some of the songs before, but I didn't become obsessed until I saw Muriel's Wedding.
I feel like when you're younger and you're like kind of discovering pop music for the first time, movies are a great way to do it. That's how, thanks to films like Good Morning Vietnam or Stand By Me. These were films that had like hit soundtracks of oldies from the 50s and 60s.
Forrest Gump was another one of those.
That's how I first learned about a lot of those songs. But I'm trying to think of something where I was an adult.
Yeah.
Where I heard like a band or like a particular pop song that made me really interested in them. Like this one tune really did it for me. Because it is a different experience.
It is. It's different. You're more like consciously aware of it.
I'll say this. This was kind of a curious one. And this wasn't from a movie. But if you remember Guitar Hero. Back in those days.
Yeah,
everyone was playing Guitar Hero.
A lot of people were introduced to a lot of different songs through Guitar Hero.
Yeah. One of the bonus songs, they were all of the licensed pop songs. Mm-hmm. And then there was like a bonus channel and it was all like original stuff made by the people who made the game. Like
a lot
of them had bands and they said, we'll put your band song on it. And I discovered a wonderful band from Alston, Massachusetts called Vagiant.
Oh, Vagiant was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vagiant was really good.
The song on Guitar Hero was called FTK.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't explain what that meant.
Yeah.
And the lyrics don't bear that out. And then I heard the uncut version, and FTK stands for Fuck the Kells. And the Kells was a horrendous frat bar in Alston, Massachusetts where all the frat boys hung out.
Oh.
And they hated it, so they wrote a song about what a shitty bar it was.
Well, that'll do it, won't it?
And all of the lyrics about, they're like, fuck you, fuck your mom, fuck your whole entire clientele. Yeah. They just hated the bar, so they wrote that song. Somehow they cleaned it up and put it in the game. But I was like the one guy in California that was buying Vagiant CDs. So they'd send like personalized notes when I ever bought one of their records.
Oh,
like,
my God, that's
thanks.
Nice.
You're our one California fan. It's like,
oh, wow. That's
they're
weird.
Usually just playing like these little bars and outside of Boston.
That's so weird.
They have three. Yeah. And I want you to buy these because they're great. One was called Vagiant Public Display of Infection. It's their first EP. Then they put out one called Vagiant Boston, because there was actually another band called Vagiant, so they had to change their name. And that was called Trash Candy. Trash Candy's really good. Then they had to change their name entirely, because even Vagiant Boston wasn't enough, so they're called Tijuana Sweetheart on their last album.
Oh, okay.
And their third record's called Under the Gun, and they're all great.
That's cool, man.
Buy those records.
That is very, very cool. Oh, I just had another one. No, it's gone now.
All right.
Anyway, but and that's a fun question, actually. And you know what? The next episode of The Iron List is actually, you brought it up, we have a poll every month to decide what the next episode of The Iron List is going to be, and the next episode is the best movie soundtracks ever.
That's right.
And we need to talk
about
this.
Which is a rough one.
Is tough, because and I think we need to clarify that one a little bit even. Usually we don't talk about it ahead of time, but I think this needs to be not musicals and not orchestral scores, because those are separate lists we can do.
Yes.
So this has got to be like
music supervision.
Music supervision. Either all new songs, like I think like Magnolia might apply, for example, like that, or pre-existing songs that are curated.
Yeah.
So there might be a thin line between new songs and musical. We'll decide that for ourselves. But yeah, we're going to be focusing on, and my short list is nuts, and there's a few things I really want to get to, because I know the soundtrack, but I've actually never seen the movie. Not that that's the important thing, but I at least want people to talk about it. So I got a few things I need to catch up on there. But I'm really excited, because we usually don't spend a lot of time talking about music.
Hmm.
You're way more of a music nerd than I am. Like, I like music a lot, don't get me wrong, and I used to sing in bands and stuff like that.
I don't have great taste in pop music.
You don't have great taste in pop music, but you do have great taste in music. You have an interesting taste, and you are very well aware of things, and you have a partner who's a huge music nerd, and you've been exposed to things that I haven't.
It's my wife who's, like, the proper rock nerd. Right, but you've been exposed
to things that I have.
Yeah.
And you probably are more articulate about them in some regards. I studied singing for many, many years, and I've done some performing here and there, but when it comes to actual just following music, I haven't done it very regularly in a long time. And I was looking at my list of like my picks for the best soundtracks ever, and I'm looking at like, would any other human being alive put that on there? And I'm not sure they would, but in any case, it should be a fun Iron List. I'm looking forward to recording it, but we need some time to put that one together. We have time for one more?
We should make mixes and put them on, like, Spotify.
Oh, that'd be fun. Oh, bless you.
Excuse me.
That'd be fun. Yeah, can we still do that? Do you still do, like, mixes and put them on Spotify?
Yeah, absolutely. Spotify still exists.
Well, I don't know.
You can curate playlists, and people who have access to it can see your playlist. I know that, I know this because I had to look up James Gunn's recently.
Oh, yeah, because he had put, like, a list of all the...
Well, just a lot of his Guardian stuff, but just a lot of his favorite songs. He's very fond of a band called Old 97s.
Oh, that's a great band. Which I love the Old 97s.
They have a song called Time Bomb. I've got a time bomb in my mind, Mom.
Old 97s did Let the Idiot Speak, or am I thinking of something else?
Oh, I don't know. But he's such a big fan of the Old 97s that he put them in one of the Guardian's Christmas special.
Oh, yeah, he did,
like,
yeah.
There's this band of aliens, it's just the Old 97s.
They're like the Greek chorus, in a way.
Yeah, that's Rhett Miller in the Old 97s.
Let the Idiot Speak is the Old 97s, okay. Yeah. Really good song.
I know about them because my wife is a fan, and she's introduced me to the Old 97s.
I think Let the Idiot Speak was on the Scott Pilgrim comic books had, like, a mix. They didn't have, like, a proper mix thing you could get, but they had, like, a list of songs that inspired this particular chapter of the series. And that was actually where I was... It's not movies, but it's where I was exposed to Plumtree. Plumtree was, I think, a Canadian sort of alt-rock band, kind of along the lines. Kind of sounded like a little bit like the Breeders. Is it the Breeders? Who did Cannonball?
Cannonball. Oh, yeah, that
was the Breeders,
that's
right?
The Breeders. Yeah.
Yeah, they sound a bit like the Breeders. They did a song, I think it was actually called Scott Pilgrim, which is what he named his protagonist after, and so I looked up that band. That's a great fucking band. A really fun rock band.
The Breeders are really great.
Oh, the Breeders are really great, too, but also Plumtree. Which I think even Scott Pilgrim actually wears a Plumtree t-shirt in the movie. Not very well known, but they put out like 3 albums and they're all very, very good. Anyway, we got time for one more. Or do we?
Oh, do we?
No, we're done. All right, we're done. Sorry. All right. That is it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you everybody for joining us. I know we have some new people because we have our new Godzilla podcast that might be inviting some people over. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for subscribing. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Leave us a review if you haven't already. It really, really helps. And if you really want to help us out a lot, you can head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where you can listen to all of our regular shows from, you know, current regular shows, ad-free. You can also get a whole bunch of exclusive podcasts, including our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays. We review every single episode of Star Trek ever. There's a giant back catalog available if you want to subscribe right now. Instantly available. We've got Only the Best. We review every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture. And you can get episodes of Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early. You can also vote for stuff like The Iron List, and we do Discord hangouts and things as well. Thank you to all of our patrons. Without you, we wouldn't exist. We're incredibly grateful to you. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And again, if you cannot afford to join us on Patreon, we totally get it. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Leave us a review. Whitney, tell people how they can contact us on the We've Got Mails.
You mean through our actual mail?
Yeah.
Write an actual letter. We like getting those. Put it in an envelope. Mail it to us to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. We'd like to hear from you.
Yep. And our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We're on Twitter. Dang it.
Still, dang it. It's a sewer, but we're there. We're
just getting worse, but by God, we've staked our claim. We are at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We think you're great. And, hope you're doing awesome and feeling good. And thank you, everybody who wrote in. Sorry if we didn't get to your letter. We've got another podcast coming. Hey, that's what we do. Sincerely. Anyway, bye. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney. Right, bye.